The Mysteries of Watergate, Episode 31, Baking Baker.
I want to talk to you tonight from my heart on a subject of deep concern to every American.
Those who hate you don't win unless you hate them.
I've been charged with involvement.
A full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
What has come to be known as the Watergate Affair.
Hello, I'm John O'Connor, author of Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. As of the summer of 1974, the CIA, the DNC, Mullen, and Dean had all escaped detection masterfully, thanks to their friends with the Washington Post. The Post had not reported honestly about the odd circumstances of the burglary, as we have described, reporting that would have put on this criminality an odd cast indeed. The Post, most shamefully, did not tell the public a highly important fact, the location of most, underline most, of the burglar's activities, that is, the area surrounding the desk of Maxie Wells. As we have discussed, Wells was the secretary to the unprepossessing Spencer Oliver Jr., a minor official, not even an employee of the DNC, the ostensible target. Most egregiously, the Post reporters failed to report on what should have been the most memorable single domestic tableau in our country's history, the violent struggle of burglar Eugenio Martinez with Metropolitan Police Officer Carl Schaufler, resulting in the retrieval of a desk key of which Martinez sought to get rid. Soon, it downplayed any connection of Howard Hunt and the burglars to Hunt's full-time employer, Mullen & Company, and it affirmatively suggested that, notwithstanding, quote, intimations, unquote, of lawyer Douglas Caddy that somehow Mullen was connected to the CIA, there was only one long-past singular project, the Radio Free Cuba broadcast, publicly known. It appears that even though Mark Felt, a.k.a. Deep Throat, knew of Mullen's CIA cover contract, suggesting that it was giving cover to Hunt, the Post never disclosed that. And if Mullen's president, Robert Bennett's report to the CIA is to be believed, he had made an explicit deal with the Post's Bob Woodward to protect Mullen, presumably to conceal the cover contract. After alluding early on to a possible, quote, sixth participant, unquote, in the burglary, the Post went radio silent on the topic, even though young D.C. reporter Pat Collins, tailing the FBI, wrote a brilliant expose that the so-called sixth burglar was none other than Juan Lou Russell. Russell was a security guard for the CRP and, one could infer, working for James McCord. Of course, Mark Felt and other FBI sources for the Post knew of Russell, and Woodward himself met personally with Russell twice, yet never printed a word about him. The Post also appeared to bury any mention of what wiretap monitor Alfred Baldwin overheard, and for months ignored him in print altogether. The Post also concealed the CIA defense planned by Hunt, to wit, that this had been, in his mind, a valid CIA national security operation. It also concealed the prosecutor's, quote, blackmail, unquote, theme, soon quashed by Judge David Bazelon, which would have had elements of salacious overhearings and control of the CIA cover contract. It only glancingly and partially repeated the New York Times expose that Eugenio Martinez had been at arrest an active CIA agent, keeping a diary, even then suggesting, falsely, that the CIA was simply monitoring what the White House was doing. And, as we have described, the Post withheld the implications of Dean's withholding of Hunt's Hermes notebooks. Then, in a dramatic episode recounted in both book and movie, however limited the portrayal, the Post did not, at the time, publicize Deep Throat's warning that the CIA was threatening lives to keep hidden its role in Watergate, along with other operations to which such exposure would lead. As the paper was suppressing this dramatic warning from the head of the FBI's investigation, a more truthful paper, Chicago Today, was printing the threats of the CIA to one Michael Stevens, who could clearly document the wiretapping as a CIA operation. Even though Deep Throat warned that, quote, everyone's life is in danger, unquote, courtesy of the CIA, even though Chicago Today published the Stevens story, replete with CIA involvement and death threats, the Post was silent. Throughout the televised Irvin hearings in May and June of 1973, the Post failed to explore the meaningful admissions and lies of James McCord especially, which the Post understood, but the public did not. So all of this brings us to May 1974, when Earl Silbert is being confirmed in Senate hearings as a U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. In case the Post missed the CIA defense earlier, in case it missed the prosecutor's planned, quote, blackmailing, quote, theme, here it was, in sworn Senate testimony, unassailable, sensational stories that could be printed with impunity. But crickets, nothing in the Post about these disclosures. So it looked like Nixon was on his way to certain removal in early 1974 as the House Impeachment Committee, sometimes named after Chairman Peter Rodino of New Jersey, was moving into articles of impeachment. But there was one wild card still to turn over, maybe. From the outset of the 1973 Urban Committee hearings, there was the distant but distinct rumble of possible CIA participation. I believe a trial lawyer with more aggressive instincts may have decided that there was simply too much circumstantial evidence of CIA participation to ignore. As we have pointed out, the Post had hidden the most clearly damning CIA evidence, but still and yet, 6 out of 7 burglars participating had not only worked for the CIA, but had worked together on the Bay of Pigs. The Senate had heard testimony that Hunt had been exploring a CIA defense and had wanted McCord to support it. Eugenio Martinez was reported to have been an active CIA agent at the time of the burglary, a role minimized in public perception by the CIA's contention that he merely had monitored the Cuban community and was making only $100 per month at the time of the arrest. Both Martinez and Gonzalez had said publicly that they had thought they were on a CIA mission in Watergate, but the Post put that down with the, quote, duped Cuban, unquote, trope. That is, that Hunt had fooled them. Certainly, this could have been enough for an inquiring trial lawyer to suspect strongly that the Watergate burglary was at least in part an operation which the CIA had infiltrated for its own hidden purposes. In 1973, Minority Chairman Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee described in colloquial terms the seeming vague but persistent evidence of CIA participation. "It's like animals crashing around in the forest. You can hear them, but you can't see them," Baker said. So it is with this background in mind that we describe the drama within the CIA reaching its climax in early 1974. As we have described, Mark Felt learned that a man named Pennington had picked up McCord at the jail upon making bail. Felt immediately suspected that Pennington was McCord's CIA handler or cutout to the agency. And please recall that immediately after the burglary, at least after confirming that Mullen was a CIA cover contractor, that Felt had concluded that Watergate had been a White House job, a CIA job, or both. Parenthetically, this opinion Felt communicated to his boss Patrick Gray on or around June 21, 1972, whereupon Gray relayed Felt's opinion to the omnipresent John Dean. This was likely Dean's source for his advice to the Oval Office that they should use the CIA as a basis to call the FBI off the Mexican money trail. This scheme, in turn, caught on tape and publicly disclosed in July 1974, was the coup de grace for Richard Nixon's presidency, clearly proving an act of obstruction. Ironically, it was true that Watergate was in part a CIA job. Although, of course, the Mexican money trail was not part of it. This was a silly obstruction advised by an inexperienced, wet-behind-the-ears young counsel worried about his own criminal guilt. In any case, Felt saw that a promising portal through which the FBI could view CIA engagement was the mysterious Pennington. After attempting to query the CIA about a possible agent named Pennington, doing so informally, the FBI finally deemed it necessary to issue a formal request to the CIA on August 18, 1972, to identify any CIA agent named Pennington. We have covered the ultimate results of this query in prior episodes, but what we have not explained is the consternation this request caused within the agency itself. Why, you may ask, would this be so important? After all, if the CIA tells lies professionally, why couldn't it simply identify Pennington and then have all concerned tell lies? There are several answers, but together they amount to this. If Pennington's role were known, the CIA was acting criminally, not only in Watergate, but elsewhere in the United States for decades, through Pennington as a domestic agent, likely in contact with undercover agents. Pennington had not been listed on the CIA's personnel roster, seemingly for purposes of deniability, and was paid by sterile check. And later, when finally confronted, the CIA would say only that Pennington's duties revolved around clipping stories from newspapers. If this clear lie were true, as we will see, many people needlessly risked jail and loss of pensions by hiding Pennington, not only from the Senate, but from its own high officials after Richard Helms' departure in early 1973. And, of course, obstructing justice by hiding Pennington from the FBI. The internal CIA struggle over Pennington began innocently enough. Pennington, while McCord was still in jail, went to McCord's home and helped Mrs. McCord burn in the fireplace documents showing McCord's connection to the CIA, presumably his continuing post-employment connection with the CIA in an undercover capacity. The two burned such a volume of documents that smoke escaped the fireplace, discoloring the living room ceiling. When the head of the Security Research Staff, or SRS, recalled it was the most clandestine part of the very shadowy OS, or Office of Security, General Paul Gaynor, its head, heard of this, he reportedly laughed uproariously. It was so amusing to him that he related the story to an aide, Edward Sale. A conscientious man felt the need to report the incident to Security Officer Number 1, who was appointed one of the agency's, quote, focal points, unquote, on the burgeoning Watergate affair. Gaynor had also told Sale that Howard Osborne, the CIA's Director of Security, also knew about this affair. This burning had occurred around June 20, shortly after the burglary. Now we go to August 18, 1972, when the FBI requested information about Pennington. Security Officer Number 1 went to the personnel security officer, who informed Security Officer Number 1 that Pennington was too, quote, sensitive, unquote, to be given up, and to give the FBI only the name of the uninvolved Cecil Pennington. Security Officer Number 1 was so disturbed, he went to the deputy director of the OS, Stephen Kuhn, who told Security Officer Number 1 simply to write a memo for the file. As observers such as Hogan have commented, this is known as, quote, covering one's ass, unquote. However, the matter did not stop there because Richard Helms had admitted to burning massive files, generally about the agency's mind control research, as he left office in early 1973. Because of this admission, a congressional inquiry now asked the CIA for its Watergate records, and new director William Colby asked his underlings in August 1973 for a package of Watergate materials. Security Officer Number 1 was asked to prepare the package, but Kuhn told him to admit Pennington records from this package. Reluctantly, he did. But on January 21, 1974, the CIA's Inspector General asked for all Watergate records. Kuhn visited the OS Director Osborne and then told Security Officer Number 1 not to include Pennington materials to the Inspector General. Let's stop right there. Osborne, as head of the OS, reported to Colby, the CIA director, "We now have officials at the very top of the agency clearly obstructing justice, and very provably so should anyone so reveal. All of this risky criminality was performed to protect against anyone even knowing about Pennington's existence." And of course, the very clear cover-up of McCord's agency with the company. One way a federal prosecutor proves white-collar crimes is to focus on evidence of deceit, including destruction of evidence and other cover-ups. Why? To prove state of mind. These acts show a guilty mind and intentional criminality. In response to this most recent cover-up directive, the honest Security Officer Number 1, along with Security Officer Number 2, placed all Pennington materials in a sealed envelope notated, quote, for director's eyes only. They did not want to be accused of destroying evidence. Finally, the CIA's Office of Legislative Counsel on February 20, 1974, prepared a memo for Congress saying that, quote, all relevant materials, unquote, were being provided to Congress, and asked Security Officer Number 1 to sign. Security Officer Number 1 asked, do you mean all, underline all, relevant materials? He was told it meant what it said. Security Officer Number 1 at that point told the Office of Legislative Counsel about the documents. A new memo of February 23, 1974 was then prepared and sent to Congress with the explosive revelation of Pennington and his destruction of documents tying McCord to the CIA. And this was a destruction known to Howard Osborne, a very high official at the time. Meanwhile, with the Senate inquiry now winding down, Congressman Lucien Nedzi's committee was on top of this, quickly interrogating Osborne, Pennington, Gaynor, Kuhn, Sale, and the two security officers. Howard Baker, in the Senate, became deeply interested in this testimony. Now Baker had a raft of documents incriminating the CIA in a multitude of ways beyond just McCord and Pennington. But, as Nixon was hanging on by a thread, Baker needed to hurry and hope that the public would be informed of these spectacular developments soon. Let's compare the White House cover-up with the CIA cover-up. The top dogs in the White House had not known previously about Watergate, including, with the exception, possibly Haldeman or his aide Strachan, who may have known generally about an intelligence operation of Liddy. But the CIA had been deliberately and with quite guilty mind covering up, to the point of clear obstruction of justice, its own direct involvement in Watergate, which it presumably knew well before the burglaries began. Baker's 49-page report was issued on July 3, 1974, and itself is a summary. So let us summarize a summary, hitting only its biggest points. This report would, in 1974, be published, but only a few would have access and fewer still would actually read it. So the Post, in essence, knew it was invisible, and as Plato has said, an invisible man tends to be a dishonest man. The reporting on the Baker Report would be a test of the honesty of the Post. Remember, five White House officials were convicted with lives ruined for covering up administration involvement in Watergate after the fact, that is, about facts it learned after the criminality. So if the Post were to do the same thing, cover up facts it learned about Watergate's criminality, including obstruction, why wouldn't the Post agents be considered essentially criminal? Part of a great cover-up. Of course, the Post has the First Amendment on which to rely, and its reporting is not compelled by subpoena, so we do not mean to imply that the Post is subject to actual criminal liability for false reporting. In any case, the Baker Report should have been a blockbuster for the Post. Let us now list the key indictments of the CIA, which one would think the Post should have conveyed. Howard Baker, a respected senator, now concluded first that generally there were serious, credible links between the CIA and Watergate burglary, as well as the Fielding burglary about Daniel Ellsberg. More specifically, Baker documented both McCord's ongoing relationship to the CIA and Pennington's obstructive acts destroying evidence. He as well detailed the CIA's obstructive acts in addition, hiding evidence from Congress. And we might mention the FBI. The report documented deep CIA involvement in the Fielding Ellsberg burglary. The report also described Martinez's disturbed reports in March 1972 to his Miami station chief, deeply concerned about Hunt's activities. Remember, both Watergate and the Fielding burglary were only some of the operations on which the Cuban team had assisted. Recall the break-in of the Chilean embassy and the monitoring of three prominent Democratic senators who oversaw the intelligence agencies. Martinez had wanted assurances that these Hunt-led operations were known to and approved by agency brass. When the station chief relayed this concern to Washington, the CIA's director of plans, Thomas Karamessinas, told the station chief to, quote, cool it, unquote. Hunt was on White House business. The Baker Report also was clear about the Mullen cover contract, including Bennett's involvement with the agency. The CIA had refused to provide Hunt's file as being too sensitive. The Baker Report, in turn, disclosed Bennett's reports about the cover-up with Woodward and with DNC counsel, all to cover up Mullen's role as a cover contractor. Finally, the report contradicted the CIA's assertion that it had quit giving assistance to Hunt in his White House role once it learned of the Fielding Ellsberg burglary. Rather, as the report shows, the agency continued fulfilling all of Hunt's requests up through Watergate on an agency-wide basis. The report's thorough summary of agency assistance gave rise to the strong inference that Hunt was acting as a CIA agent while at the White House. Let me quote Hogan's excellent summary of the CIA assistance to Hunt and his team after Hunt went to the White House. Let me quote from Hogan's Secret Agenda, page 308, that this was an institutional commitment of the CIA rather than some, quote, runaway, unquote, operation conducted by rogue agents is plain. The support given to Hunt, McCord, and Liddy came from a broad array of agency components, the central cover staff, which helped to arrange Hunt's work for Mullen & Company, the medical services staff, which provided psychological profiles, the technical services bang and boom division, which provided disguises, clandestine cameras, voice alteration equipment, etc., the office of security, which provided safe houses for secret meetings with Hunt and Liddy, the CIA graphics section, which prepared the gemstone charts, the clandestine services division, whose deputy director, Thomas Karamesins, may well have been Hunt's case officer throughout the operation, the CIA's White House liaison office, which served as a courier for regular pouches from Hunt to Helms and the medical services staff, the external employment assistance branch, which recommended suitable retirees from the covert action staff to assist Hunt and McCord in their lockpicking and eavesdropping activities, the Western Hemisphere division, from whose ranks Martinez was drawn, and the agency's executive staff, General Cushman and Director Helms. How many other sections of the CIA may have been involved, if any, is unknown, but clearly the assistance was so broad and so deep that one can only conclude that institutional sanction had been given, secretly, unofficial, but definite, as I finish quoting from Hogan. So, with these solidly documented indictments of the Baker Report, how did the Post respond? Was it the fierce proponent of the, quote, public's right to know, unquote, or was it part of a deliberate cover-up making the White House look amateurish? On July 2, 1974, the Post Lawrence Stern did a preview, based upon sources, as to what the yet-unpublished Baker Report would say. We suspect that Stern had been bootlegged a copy. The headline for this preview, which should have trumpeted an upcoming explosive report, referenced Helms' help to get Hunt his White House job, a very pedestrian item. Now let us read to you from the headline. Quote, Baker to say CIA helped Hunt get job. This absurdly vanilla item was clearly meant to tell the public falsely that the report would be ho-hum. Then Stern summarizes the overall conclusion that will be coming. And we quote, sources who examined the report say it proves no conclusive links between the CIA and the original Watergate break-in, such as have been hinted by former White House aide Charles Colson and by Baker. According to Stern, the question that the report addresses was whether the CIA officials took, quote, efforts to minimize its involvement in the Watergate investigation. So note that Stern frames the question not as to whether the CIA was involved in the burglary, but whether it was involved at all in the investigation. Let's stop right here. We all know the value of hyping a coming attraction, a book, a boxing match, a movie, to get a wide audience. Here the Post was doing just the opposite, in essence telling the public, don't ruin your 4th of July holidays for this report. Incidentally, the nondescript headline we just quoted appeared on page 1 of the Post, ensuring that otherwise interested citizens would not follow up to the July 3 story. On July 3, with the report now published, Stern continued his reporting, but oddly did so in two different articles, one on page 1, which anyone anticipating this article would see as the main payoff from the preceding day's lead-in. Let us now quote from the page 1 headline on July 3 and the opening paragraph. Okay, first the headline, quote, report critical of CIA, Baker hints agency knew of break-in, unquote. Now the lead paragraph. The Central Intelligence Agency may have known in advance of the plans for break-ins of the offices of Daniel Ellsberg, psychiatrist, and the Democratic Committee's Watergate headquarters, a report released yesterday by Howard H. Baker, Jr., Republican of Tennessee, suggests. So this front-page headline does not talk about the issue of McCord and Hunt being undercover CIA agents, or that the break-in of both Fielding and the Watergate DNC offices were actually CIA jobs. Rather, the question posed is whether or not the CIA knew in advance of these operations, a very bland suggestion. Most readers interested in Watergate would not scour the rest of this paper for any additions to this Baker Report story, and unlikely in any case to do so on July 3. But let us stop right here. We now have two front page headline stories on consecutive days, one telling us that Richard Helms' gasp helped Howard Hunt get a job after retirement, The other told the shocking story that because of casing photos, the agency may have learned in advance of the Fielding burglary and in some form or fashion may have known in advance of the Watergate break-ins. Even this underplayed story should have, but did not, raise the interesting question as to why the CIA would have kept a casing photo for an operation as to which it had no part. Now, we have talked about a page one story. There is a second story starting on page 10. It is here that the Post finally gets down to summarizing for the reader, should the reader go to page 10, the findings and conclusions of the report. To wit, there was nothing much. Here is the page 10 headline. We quote, "Few conclusions given by Baker on CIA Watergate tie." Recall Baker's prior statement before getting these explosive documents that animals in the forest could be heard but not seen. Here are the lead-in paragraphs to this story supposedly summarizing the conclusions of the report. We quote, "Senator Howard Baker Jr., Republican Tennessee, once likened the role of the Central Intelligence Agency in the Watergate scandal to animals crashing around in the forest. You can hear them, but you can't see them. This Aesopian image still fits, notwithstanding Baker's release yesterday of a 43-page report, which is rich in insinuation, long on footnotes, but short on substantive findings." In short, this report says there's nothing here, whereas in fact there are incredibly explosive, incriminating allegations solidly documented. The report detailed the CIA's cover arrangements with Mullen, which should have led to finger hunt in this journalism. It also should have described the drama described earlier, clearly criminal obstruction designed to hide both Pennington and McCord. But here is how Stern capsulized the evidence, which waters down considerably what Baker found. Quote, "Among other things, the report describes how the CIA used a Washington public relations firm as a cover for agents operating abroad, asserts that the CIA destroyed its own records in direct conflict with the Senate request to keep them intact, asserts that a CIA operative may have been a, quote, domestic agent, unquote, in violation of the agency's charter, and recounts how one CIA employee fought within the agency against withholding information from the Senate committee and other congressional committees. The report recites several instances in which it says CIA personnel with whom the committee staff sought to interview were not made available by the CIA. In addition, the report lists several other instances in which it says the CIA either ignored, resisted, or refused requests for information and documents by the committee. Note that this report avoids nailing Hunt as an undercover agent, or McCord, or even Mullen. Later, when the article does name Mullen, it does so by describing it as a cover for agents abroad, missing the entire point. And the summary of obstructive activities makes it appear there was no obstruction at all, but only thoughts of withholding information and clearly stated objections to committee requests. In essence, normal, lawful document wrangling. Baker devotes much space to Martinez's concerns in March 1972 of Hunt's activities and post-burglary rushing his case agent to D.C. by auto without traceable use of credit cards. The essence of Baker's report was that Martinez and his chief had been concerned of illegal activities involving Hunt, but the article again made the tableau sound very bland. Here is the way Stern describes this section. Quote, "The section of the report dealing with Eugenio Martinez asserts that Martinez, a CIA operative, alerted his CIA superiors that Hunt was in Miami in early 1972. The response from the CIA to Martinez's superiors, according to the report, was that Hunt was involved in domestic White House business and to cool it. In fact, was Martinez merely alerting his superiors that Hunt was in Miami? Of course not. This is a false rendition of what the report said. This paragraph is such a dishonest rendering of the report that, if it were within the jurisdiction of the SEC, Stern would and should be a good candidate for indictment." Now let us quote the paragraph treating Pennington in the second Stern report, starting at page 10. Quote, "Baker did unearth the case of Lee R. Pennington, Jr., a $250 a month CIA contract employee, who acknowledged that he witnessed the destruction of Watergate burglar James McCord's records by his wife at their home after McCord's arrest in Watergate. CIA's then Director of Security Howard Osborne, no longer with the agency, fed files on a different Pennington to the FBI when agents made inquiries about the incident, presumably to throw the Bureau off the track. Columnist Jack Anderson reported the incident several months ago. Of course, left out of this is the notion that Pennington himself helped burn those documents, and most importantly, to hide any evidence of McCord's ongoing link to the CIA. That is the big headline, but that was omitted by Stern. Now, at least that page 10 article names Pennington. If the reader only read the page 1 article, following it to its continuation on page 8, the Pennington affair is even more airbrushed, not even naming him, and calling him a, quote, former federal investigator, not a CIA contractor. Now, let me quote from page 8, the continuation of the page 1 headlined article of July 3rd, quote, "The Osborne material, as presented by Baker, suggests that the former CIA security director provided misleading information to the FBI on the identity of a former federal investigator who helped Watergate burglar James McCord's junior wife destroy CIA records at their home immediately after her husband's arrest in the Watergate break-in case. By calling Pennington only a former federal investigator, he is clearly trying to dissociate the CIA from the burning of these documents. As we have described, the Baker Report speaks of a massive agency-wide effort to aid Hunt, notwithstanding agency claims to have ended the help shortly before the Ellsberg burglary. The big point of Baker's report is specific. The agency never terminated widespread support of Hunt. But Stern clearly and quite dishonestly says the opposite. Let us quote, "The report asserts and the CIA denies that it was only when these photographs were developed that assistance to Hunt by the agency was terminated," unquote. This refers to the photos of the casing of the Ellsberg psychiatrist. So Stern directly says dishonestly that the agency stopped the support of Hunt, and the only question was when. Finally, Stern's report ignores altogether the CIA documentation showing Bennett's claims to have hushed up Woodward and the Post, minimizing Bennett's use of attorney Hobart Taylor to intercede with the Williams firm to hush up the story. Let me quote, "The report asserts that Bennett, quote, funneled, unquote, information to Edward Bennett Williams, then a lawyer for the Democratic National Committee and the Washington Post, through another Washington lawyer, Hobart Taylor," unquote. Note that there is nothing here about keeping Mullen's role out of the news, the subject of Bennett's deal with Woodward, and his assignment to Taylor to lobby the Williams firm to hush referring publicly to Mullen. In other words, he ignores the cover-up of Mullen's undercover status. So now let us briefly reflect on the meaning of this reporting. The Post has since 1972 held itself out as the sole reporting of note on Watergate knowledge. The Post knocked Nixon out of the box, it loudly proclaims. Its reporting was spot on. Given this preening acknowledgement that the world depend upon it for Watergate knowledge, can't we agree that this puts an even heavier burden on the Post as a prize for its accolades? That is, to tell the truth. The whole country, by the Post's own admission, was looking to the paper for the real truth behind this strange affair, beyond the seeming dissembling and half-truths of various witnesses and parties. It's clear that very few in the public reflexively believed Nixon or Mitchell, Hunter McCord, Dean or Magruder. The public looked to the Post for the real story. What strikes me, and I assume it will strike you, is that Stern and the Post editors went to great lengths to tamp down, indeed mischaracterize, the findings of the Baker Report, which is in black and white. What about the clear findings underlined in the original February 23, 1974 CIA memo that Pennington burned documents to hide the link between McCord and the CIA? How about Mullen's cover contract seemingly applying to Hunt as an undercover agent, while the CIA gave him consistent agency-wide support? This and so many clear facts were simply covered up with lies and half-truths by our Watergate paper of record. I have read you key excerpts from the Post reporting on the Baker Report. If any listeners have the time or inclination, they can examine the Baker Report online. I think you will find that my rendition does not overplay the findings of the report. If anything, the constraints of time have forced me to truncate and summarize, whereas the cumulative detail, small but consistent, results in an avalanche of facts, all important ones misrepresented or ignored by the Post. Why is this reporting so significant? Because if the Post has to lie about findings in black and white issued by a respected senator, How is the Post treating other facts not so readily accessible? Now let's venture back to the dramatic garage meeting of May 16 and 17, 1973, where Deep Throat exclaims everyone's life's in danger. We know of this now because Woodward and Bernstein sold many books and had a hit movie because of it. They therefore included the episode for commercial purposes. But, for informational, educational, truth-to-power, public's right-to-know, hard-hitting investigative journalism purposes, we know that Woodward, Bernstein, and Bradley, each of whom dramatically were emblazoned with this story, all kept their typewriters silent on this. Why? Because it would have helped Nixon, for Nixon to know and for the public to know that the CIA wished not to reveal its true role in Watergate. Deep Throat was giving the paper a dead-on statement of the CIA's involvement in Watergate, as well as other illegal operations, in the garage that night. But yet it was not reported, and we know the source was highly reliable. This now also leads to the Post's failure to print a word about Russell, or worse, his mysterious death. This would have been an interesting story, but not one fitting its template of dishonesty. How would you feel, I will ask each person rhetorically in this audience, if the Post smeared you while covering up exculpating facts which you suspected or intuited but did not know as firmly as the Post? How would you feel if your life was ruined by a newspaper's dishonesty in concealing these facts which would have helped you? Of course, we can all know that it is difficult to feel sympathy for Richard Nixon, at least for the one not empathetic with the circumstances of his spirit-crushing upbringing, with the natural resentments of one who has had no easy social graces, who was too poor to attend Harvard, and perhaps became overly resentful. But as Nixon brooded in his post-presidency, hoping to restore to some degree his reputation, the post-principles Woodward, Bernstein, Bradley, dined out on their destruction of this odd, churlish, but highly accomplished president. If they had destroyed him fairly, with truth told without fear or favor, that is one thing. They should be proud of that reporting. But if they did not, shouldn't they be the ones on whom we heap shame and obloquy? But let's talk more broadly about the harm to society that the Post false journalism causes. For the past decades, approaching 50 years, students have been taught false history. A president of great accomplishments with worldwide impact has now been reduced on the pages of history to a common criminal. Nixon's China opening, his discontinuation of the gold standard, his SALT arms reduction treaties, his escalation, then withdrawal from South Vietnam, with at least debatable conditions of honor, were all world-shaking events. Yet the history of his administration focuses on Watergate. Watergate should have led to a broad discussion, yes, of Nixon's dirty tricks campaign, which, as noted, did not include Watergate. Watergate should also have been tackled as part of an out-of-control intelligence community, accountable to no one, and an executive branch, including its presidential administration, that is so large and unwieldy as to allow rogue wiretapping and burglary operations without the knowledge and consent of the Oval Office. Tangentially, perhaps, and to a lesser extent, it should have also been about a political culture in Washington tied closely to prostitution and the buying and selling of females. Yet, because of the post-journalism, our society was robbed of a meaningful discussion of these issues. Instead, in 1972, our society began the deification of the bread and circuses of scandal and gotcha journalism, no longer considered distasteful muckraking. Our political culture, as a result of deceitful post-journalism, has become a scandal culture. We have come to the end of this episode discussing the momentous Baker Report, or one that should have been momentous, and the covering up of that report by the Post, the Watergate's paper of record. We have solved yet another mystery of Watergate. Thank you for listening. I have just completed a book on the same subject entitled The Mysteries of Watergate, What Really Happened. While it covers the material in our podcast, I have added two chapters of contextual materials and removed the repetition needed for a podcast. For those enjoying this series, it will serve as a valuable historical reference. For your non-listening friends, it will prove enlightening and entertaining. Thank you for your support.